Next up. Dr. Stephen Halbrook is an attorney and author. His PhD in philosophy is from Florida State University. His law degree is from Georgetown University Law Center. Dr. Halbrook authored the amicus brief for 55 senators, the president of the Senate, and 250 congressmen in D.C. versus Heller. He is the author of Firearms Law Desk Book, Federal and State Criminal Practice, 2011, The Founder's Second Amendment, Origins of the Right to Bear Arms, 2008. Every one of you should have a copy of that. They came in late last night, and Bob made a special trip down here to deliver those. Freedmen, the 14th Amendment, and the Right to Bear Arms, 1866 to 76, which was published in 1998, and reissued in 2010 under the title Restoring Civil Rights, and his 1984 book, That Every Man Be Armed, The Evolution of a Constitutional Right. Dr. Halbrook argued Costello versus United States before the Supreme Court in 2000. He argued Prince versus United States before the Supreme Court in 1997. He argued United States versus Thompson Center Arms before the Supreme Court in 1992. Dr. Halbrook won all three cases. We are honored to have him with us today. He will speak on the right to carry and how it fits with the right to keep and bear. At tab number 9 is the amicus brief that Dr. Halbrook filed in the Peruta case in California. The case is a challenge to California's May issue carry permit. Thank you.
Thank you, Allison. It's a nice day outside. Why don't we reconvene out on the lawn? I mean, we used to do that when I used to teach philosophy.
Are you kidding?
Let's go.
Is there a lawn out there?
Well, I don't know. It's kind of a parking lot and then a drop off in the back. But we're near Rock Creek Park, so. First, I got to say something about Bowie knives. I mean, they're really cool. I've got some. Those were Bowie knives and Dirks and or Arkansas toothpicks. Those were some of the first weapons that were banned for concealed carry. And those laws are still in the books in a lot of states. And I used to do a lot of local criminal work, and Virginia still bans concealed carry of Bowie knives and Dirks. And so I've had clients long ago charged with these crimes. And what they're coming in with would be like regular kind of smaller knives or hunting knives or something like that. And so I would bring a couple of items with me, a book called History of American Knives. It shows real Bowie knives, and as Dave Hardy was describing them, they're like really big. And they have specific designs and not just any old knives. And so, and then I had this book on Bowie knives of the Confederacy. There were a lot of photographs taken in the early years of the war, you know, people in uniform, and they would be brandishing their weapons, and there were a lot of Bowies, and they were all like that tall, they'd be holding them like that. And so I would always get those cases dismissed because these were not Bowie knives or Dirks. So a little history there. The sampling you have of some of my work on the right to bear arms is a brief of Congress of Racial Equality and amicus brief we did in Peruta. There's some similar material in other briefs, or other cases rather, that we have filed. This is a big issue, whether there is any right to bear arms. It was always denied that the right to keep and bear arms meant that you could keep any arm or could bear any arm, and Heller held that obviously that there's a right to keep a handgun in the home. That's the narrow holding, but it reached that holding on the basis of far broader considerations as to the text and original understanding. So what we're faced with now, basically, courts are saying that Heller only said you can have a handgun in your home, period. And whatever it said about the right to bear arms other than that, no, we're not going there. The Supreme Court in the last few months has denied cert in two cases. One of them I filed, a case called Williams versus Maryland. The state of Maryland has a discretionary issuance policy for concealed weapon permits. Actually, you cannot carry a handgun at all in that state, either openly or concealed. And you've got to be either a big contributor to the sheriff's campaign fund or fit within certain narrow employment categories to get a concealed weapon permit. My client was a young man in Prince George's County who legally purchased a handgun from a store, passed the NICS background check, and had it at his girlfriend's house, and he was taking it to his house, and he was seen by a police officer and arrested, and so he gets a 3-year prison term. It's a felony in Maryland to carry a pistol without a permit. And so the case went up to the Maryland Supreme Court, and actually they call it the Maryland Court of Appeals. I mean, that's the Maryland Court of Special Appeals. And the court basically said this, that we don't recognize any right to carry a gun, and if the right to bear arms means that, the U.S. Supreme Court's going to have to tell us that. We're not going to do that on our own. So there you have a court basically saying, probably not, and not just probably, not liking what the Supreme Court has held now in Heller and then in McDonald, basically saying that we're not going to recognize anything that's in the text of the Constitution unless the Supreme Court tells us we have to do it. And so cert was denied in that case. Then a few weeks later, this Massiandero case out of the Fourth Circuit, basically the same thing happened in that case. And they even, Fourth Circuit decision, cited the Maryland and quoted the Maryland language. There was a kind of a convoluted opinion where one judge wrote the opinion of the court except on the issue of bearing arms. Harvey Wilkinson wrote the opinion of the court on that issue, basically quoting the Maryland language and saying that we don't want to be responsible for any mayhem that may take place if we recognize this right to bear arms. And of course, it was a completely innocuous situation. It was, at the time of the offense, it was illegal to have a loaded firearm owned in a federal park. And then there was a bill passed, which President Obama signed, saying that we're going to go by state law on that issue, and it's not going to be a federal offense. So it became, after the guy had been arrested and in the course of the prosecution, it became a non-crime. But then when the case gets to the Court of Appeals, it's a non-crime then, but the court says, oh, we don't want to like recognize or promote mayhem. So there you have it. It's not even a crime anymore. I mean, if ever there's a case without any prosecutorial merit and they're only doing it for their batting average, that's the kind of case. So the court denied cert in that case. And so it's clear the Supreme Court apparently doesn't want to go there right now in terms of this issue. Probably they want to have maybe the lower court case law percolate more. There are some federal courts that have recognized the right to carry arms or to bear arms. There's other courts that have not. And with the state courts, you have a different situation because most states have a right to bear arms guarantee in their state constitutions. And it's very rare that a state Supreme Court, other than a state like Massachusetts, has said that doesn't mean anything, or that a state right to bear arms guarantee really means that the state has a right to have a National Guard. That's what the Massachusetts court held in the Davis case back in, I guess, the late 60s. So, but it's really weird to say there would be a state guarantee to bear arms to protect the state from the federal government banning state militias. Because if the federal government had power to do that, no state constitutional guarantee could interfere with it. So anyway, none of this was an issue until about the 1960s when this collective rights doctrine was basically invented, that there's no right to keep and bear arms, and it really means a state has a right to a militia, and then that became the sophisticated collective rights view where epitomized in Justice Stevens' dissenting opinion in the Heller case, right, where he says there's an individual right to bear arms in the militia. Can you imagine the implications of that if it was really true? Does that mean you have a right to be in a militia? I mean, the militia is like, that's like a compulsory command society situation, right? You're compelled to be in it. You're compelled by law to be in it. You're told what to do when you're in it. And if you don't do what you're told, you're subject to discipline, including the ultimate sanction, right? How could anybody say that's a right instead of a duty? But that's what we ended up with because it became so clear that they couldn't deny anymore that when the Constitution, the Second Amendment refers to the people and these individuals. So they said, okay, you've got an individual right and you can bear arms in a militia. I mean, what happens if you're really in a militia or any other military force and the commander says, you're going to peel potatoes or you're going to do this or that, and you say, no, I'm going to walk around with my Smith & Wesson 44 Magnum and, you know, bear arms. Hell, I've got a right to do so, right? No, not. So you never have any follow-up to the argument about the militia. So what do you have, in Stevens' dissent, the rest of the dissent is about making references from the founders and others to the militia. Well, of course they were interested in the militia, but that wasn't the be-all and end-all of the Second Amendment. It had more than one concept. Just like the First Amendment, there was more than the right to religion. There's assembly, there's speech, press. So anyway, that's where we are now in terms of the court system. And I think the purpose of this conference is to stir up scholarship. And the brief that you see is just an example of bringing, I think, historical scholarship to bear in current litigation. Lawyers aren't really trained to do that too much. You go to law school, you read case books, and you read cases. It can be very boring. Can you think outside the box? Can we think about the text of the Constitution? Can we think about the historical meaning and not just, you know, the way that Justice Breyer does constitutional law cases? I saw a debate between him and Scalia. Scalia said, I look at the text, I look at original meaning and go from there. And Justice Breyer said, well, I give reasons for my opinions. So, you know, like, what's my public policy alternative or preference? And then I give reasons for that. So, when we look at the right to keep and bear arms, it's, okay, we're past keeping arms under Heller. That means possession, at least in the home. And does bear arms mean anything aside from that? Because some courts will say that it doesn't, and the Supreme Court's going to have to tell us if it does. But just textually, there's no rule of law that a court cannot reach a conclusion just because there's no prior Supreme Court case. If suddenly they put military troops in your home, and it's not even in wartime, don't you think a judge would do something in terms of a Third Amendment claim? They wouldn't just throw up their hands and say, well, there's no Supreme Court precedent on point. Because it's never happened in U.S. history. Why would there be a Supreme Court precedent? And you know what? This comes up a lot in the qualified immunity doctrine cases, doesn't it? Where you've got civil rights violation, like the Fourth Amendment violation, and the police officers always say when they get hit with the civil suit that, well, there's no precedent right on point. There was a case, the Grove versus Ramirez, that ended up in the Supreme Court, which has excellent language refuting that. And what the court basically said, if something is prohibited by the clear text of the Constitution, don't come in here saying that you've got qualified immunity just because there's no Supreme Court case on point or other precedent in your jurisdiction. In the Grove case, an ATF agent served a warrant to search for firearms and didn't say anything about what they were searching for. And remember, the Fourth Amendment has the clause about particularly describing the thing to be seized. It didn't matter that there was no precedent. And that case, I think, was the liberals on the court voted to uphold liability and to reject qualified immunity, and the so-called conservatives were on the side of the ATF agent. So you never know. You have strange bedfellows many times. It's not clear who's going where in these cases. Speaking of the Third Amendment, that's a good example to show textual analysis that we need to have more of. Let me go back to the Second Amendment language, for example. You know, the argument that you only have a right to keep and bear arms in the militia. Well, if you look at the Fifth Amendment, the indictment clause, you'll see contrasting language about the Second Amendment. You'll see that that an indictment shall issue by a grand jury except for, it mentions armed forces or something like that, or militia when on duty. So don't you think they knew how to say militia when on duty? And so in the Second Amendment, if it was only right to bear arms in the militia when on duty, don't you think they knew how to say that? They said it in the Fifth Amendment. And so what I'm trying to get you to do is to think about textual analysis using the language of the entire Constitution when you're looking at only one provision. What do they say in other provisions? And I think with the argument there's no right to bear arms outside the home, one good example would be the fact that there's mention of houses in other parts of the Constitution. For example, in the Third Amendment, they say no quartering of soldiers in houses. Whether they could do it in businesses or on other premises, that's not prohibited by the Third Amendment. There might be other violations, maybe due process or compensation clause issues. I don't know what they would be, but they knew how to use the word house. So don't you think they could say there's a right to keep and bear arms in your house? Or the Fourth Amendment reference to the right to be secure against unreasonable search and seizures in your person's papers, houses, and effects. They knew how to say houses. And other provisions of the Constitution. I mean, this analysis, the people who argued, all of us who argued the individual rights view going way back, I think we didn't have enough proper focus initially on this textual analysis. The people, I mean, that is one thing that we knew how to talk about. When the Constitution refers to the people, it normally means people. It doesn't mean units of government. The word right, I think, we came a little later in the game thinking about using the word right, the right of the people. There's no place in the Constitution that talks about governmental units having rights. They only have powers. Article 1, Section 8, Congress shall have power. Powers not delegated to the feds are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people. So the people have powers and rights, but there's no instance when the states or the federal government is said to have rights. And that's why the term states' rights was always a misnomer. That term appeared very early in the Republic, but it was never correct. States have powers. So when the Parker case, and we're having Judge Silberman tonight as our speaker, when that case was decided, there was a dissent by Judge Henderson. And they did a word search, and they found that if you look at the Constitution, throughout it, the word states is used, I don't know how many times, to refer to the state governments, or at least the states as political units. And therefore, in the Second Amendment, when they refer to being necessary to the security of a free state, they must admit the state governments. And so that was the basis of the dissenting opinion in the Parker case. The Second Amendment's not an individual right. It doesn't apply in the district because the district's not a state. But hello, how many times in the Constitution does it use the word free state? And how many times did you do a word search for that? Well, it's only one. And that's because if you look at the 18th century political linguistics, free state and a free society. In fact, when Madison introduced the amendment, he used the term free society, June 8, 1789, the first version of the Bill of Rights, necessary to the security of a free society, not a free state. And then you start looking at purposes. This is another instance where the term bear arms, I think there's textual support for getting outside the home. Like the first clause of the Second Amendment, why we're going to militia. Sounds like there may be instances in when you would bear arms in a militia. And how many times do you do that in your home? And then, of course, as Heller pointed out, in its analysis to show that bear arms didn't mean just militia use, it was more important to the founders that you had a right to bear arms for self-defense or hunting than for militia purposes, just as individual people would think. In other words, I'm more interested in defending my home or elsewhere. I'm more interested in avoiding hunting than doing militia duty. Although back in those days, when they would have militia musters, they had a lot of fun. They would come in town on a weekend and they would do their militia drills, they would get drunk, they would party. And so you have this movement of these Puritan ministers denouncing those practices. And I'm convinced that's what led to the demise of the militia, at least in the northeastern states. It was the demise of the militia probably happened in the southern states because of the Civil War and the aftermath. But in the northern states, I mean, they knew how to party. This was denounced by religious fanatics, and therefore you had this disuse of the militia and is withering away, basically. But anyway, how many of these constitutionally protected activities do you do only in the home? To the extent militia activity is protected, that's an outdoor activity. Bearing arms, it doesn't make any sense to talk about bearing arms in your home. You keep arms in your home. And then for hunting or other purposes like that, unless you're hunting rats or something, I don't know. How many of you have ever been hunting in your home? It just doesn't make any, okay. What were you hunting?
Squirrels that went to the
right. Raptors. Yeah. And how did you dispatch them?
I used CBs and a .22.
Okay. I had that happen once, and I used a rat trap, and it worked really good. So you didn't have to wait for them. So those are some things to think about. Of course, one thing that the court does in Heller, and it comes very natural and logical, was it Dave or Don that was talking about the Pennsylvania, that was David Hardy talking about the Pennsylvania Declaration of Rights, being the first one to mention the right of the people to bear arms in defense of themselves and the state. It seems so obvious that bearing arms meant carrying them around and it meant an individual right. But if you go back to the 80s and 90s, and George Malcolm, I'm sure you'll remember this, and others here that were around right on this topic at the time, an argument was made that themselves meant the state. It did not mean individuals. So to bear arms in defense of themselves and the state meant to bear arms in defense of the state and the state. When you look at what people wrote at the time, I mean, they used themselves to mean people, individuals, and maybe an even better example was the proposal of the Pennsylvania Minority in 1788, in terms of having the Federal Bill of Rights. They had a laundry list, didn't they? But they wanted to recognize the right of the people to bear arms in defense of the national government, themselves, for hunting. And they went on to say, but you could disarm people for crimes committed or something like that. I mean, so they had both the what you could do and the exceptions for it. We end up in the Second Amendment without either one of those. You don't have a laundry list of activities that you can bear arms for, but nor do you have any explicit exception to it. So you could argue that, well, felons and everybody else has a right to bear arms, but we have the traditional exceptions. I mean, you normally have a right to life, too, right? But if you commit murder back in those days, you could be very readily executed or receive capital punishment. So there's exceptions to rights. I think we've gone too far in probably admitting that felons forfeit all rights because there's way too many felonies now. If you look at the over-federalization of the criminal law in the United States Code, it's just incredible. There's actually a really good initiative. I don't know how far it'll go because it's gone. The criminal code is so big now, but I think it's Heritage and National Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys, lawyers, has a joint project. They've got a really nice booklet about, we've got to get mens rea back into federal criminal statutes. You've got so many, more than half the criminal laws that are getting passed now, never even went through either one of the judiciary committees. They're coming out of committees where the people don't even think about mens rea or intent or willfulness issues at all. Anyway, we've got, I think I got to that thought because of the fact that the Pennsylvania Minority listed exceptions to the Second Amendment. So I think we can admit that there certainly are exceptions, but we need to get more into it. As applied basis of that, you know, the misdemeanor crime of domestic violence ban on possession of a firearm, for example. There's been a developing case law, and at first they were saying that these people forfeit all Second Amendment rights, but fortunately there's been a movement in the judiciary to recognize as applied challenges. Now, the ones that have been made, when they apply it to those people, they're basically dirtbags and they don't deserve recognition of the right to bear arms. These are the cases that end up getting reported. Maybe the ones that don't get reported never got prosecuted, maybe because they would be stupid to prosecute these people on an as-applied basis. Now, going back to our discussion about concealed carry, the very first case to be decided on that issue was Bliss versus Kentucky, and they held, the Supreme Court of Kentucky held, that basically a law prohibiting concealed carry of handguns and bowie knives and all that is unconstitutional because there was a right in the Kentucky Constitution like that of Pennsylvania to bear arms in defense of themselves and the states. They said, how could you say you could ban concealed carry any more than you could ban open carry? If you could ban one, you could ban the other. And so actually it's hard to defeat that logic. It ended up getting rejected by courts in other states, but Kentucky actually amended its constitution to take care of that. There was authority given to the state to prohibit the practice of carrying concealed weapons. So they did it the right way anyhow, rather than the judiciary making up that rule. But I never figured out why they passed that law when they passed it. I think it was in, was it 1812 or 14? I know, Clayton, you remember this.
Yeah, it's 1813, I think. It is related to the whole problem of dueling and honor culture.
Right.
The 1850 Constitutional Convention debates have a very lengthy discussion of why they were amending the state constitution to prohibit concealed carry, and they are explicit that it is related to the question of dueling.
Right. And I never could figure out why in 1813 they would prohibit concealed weapons when we were in a war and we were losing, basically, and it was like, you know, usually gun control is not an issue when we're in wars. We had this huge gun control movement in the 1930s in this country, and by the time after Pearl Harbor, it totally became irrelevant and withered away. And nothing more was said about it until about the early 60s.
Kentuckians weren't well behaved, was one of the problems. They had a very serious problem. They actually had a real problem they were trying to deal with. They didn't come up with the right solution, but they were trying to, they had a number of these states attempt to solve a genuine difficulty that there's a lot of just mindless brawling being done
right.
by young men with too much to drink and not enough to do.
Right. And these laws, of course, apply to everybody. And instead of just banning, which were a phrase were already prohibited under common law. But anyway, there's a great lesson for this today because, of course, Heller cites Nunn versus State, which invalidated Georgia's ban on open carry of pistols. Under the Second Amendment, Georgia had no constitutional guarantee on arms.
Was it
1840-something, I forgot the exact date.
1846.
It's one of the most excellent examples of a judicial opinion in those days applying the Bill of Rights directly to the states, in particular this right, because it talked about the origin of the right as an ancient natural right, and of course you have a right to defend yourself, and discussing the need to actually to train young men and women in arms, and basically it's just a wonderful example of a recognition of a very traditional right. And then there's other court cases that were decided in the antebellum period that Heller cited. The one from Alabama, Reed, State versus Reed, which said that, although it upheld a concealed weapon ban, but it said that if they made it where you can't carry the weapon at all or make it useless for self-defense, that would be unconstitutional. And so the Heller case approves of these decisions, and it basically uses them also to show not only what bare arms meant, but to show that it's acceptable to to regulate how arms are carried. And don't you think that implies that there's a right somehow to bear arms outside the home? When the court goes into this much detail to talk about carrying arms outside the home. And then we come to the presumptively lawful language in the Heller case. My favorite one for purposes of bearing arms outside the home is that they said, well, it's presumptively lawful that you could prohibit carrying arms in sensitive places, like government buildings and schools. Hello, those are outside the home. And so if you can ban carrying arms in sensitive places, don't you think that means you can, you cannot ban them in non-sensitive places or places that have some, don't have some other exception? I mean, is your home the only non-sensitive place? And here's what really gets me about the way courts are treating that language about these presumptively lawful regulations or bans on felons and mentally ill people having guns, things like that. That's dictum, but it's very important dictum. And the court says presumptively lawful, it doesn't say irrebuttably lawful. It means you can still challenge these laws and on an as-applied basis in particular. But they act like that's a holding in the case. But all these other things that the court said, which was a lot more about bearing arms for self-defense, for militia, for hunting, all these other things the court said, the courts, lower court, courts are now saying that we're not going to recognize anything about bearing arms because Heller didn't say anything about it or Heller didn't hold anything about it. We're going to limit it to keeping arms in the home. So it's like a vast contrast there where they're seizing upon some dictum to uphold laws as basically you're unable to challenge them versus here's something the court said that was the basis for its decision. Bearing arms doesn't just mean militia duty. And they said a lot more of that in the courts that don't want to recognize any right to bear arms are ignoring what the court said about that. And then there's a few other tidbits where the court said self-defense is central to the right to keep and bear arms and it's most acute in the home. Well, if it's most acute in the home, doesn't that imply that it's maybe acute somewhere else, just not as much as in the home. So basically what you've got is kind of a massive resistance or nullification of the Supreme Court decision in Heller and in McDonald. And we saw the same thing after the Lopez case, right? Lopez held that you can't just ban mere possession of guns on a schoolyard. The federal government cannot. Obviously the states can. But after that decision came down, in other words, there was a challenge to a law under the Commerce Clause, and the Supreme Court said, we agree with the challenge. I was at oral argument that day, and one of the justices asked the Solicitor General arguing the case, or Assistant Solicitor General, can you think of any federal law that would not be justifiable under the Commerce Clause? So what would your answer be, by the way, if you were in his shoes? Like, I can't think of any right now. That's what he said. It's like he could think of some later. What were you going to say?
Is that forcing people to buy health care? Yes.
You're so out of line. Of course you can do that.
Just a general murder statute, possibly?
That affects interstate commerce. That affects all crimes.
Murder?
Well, of course it does. I mean, it makes insurance more expensive.
And if you have it in the aggregate, there's no one to do commerce.
In the Gabrielle Giffords case, there were actually federal murder indictments.
Say again?
In the Gabrielle Giffords shooting, there actually were federal murder indictments. Totally separate from the fact that they were at a federal place. They were actually considering just using the federal murder statute that someone...
Yeah, but also high murder rates can discourage tourism.
Yep. Right.
And by the same theory, the federal government can prohibit masturbation because it interferes with interstate commerce in the Nevada brothels.
I think that.
But no, I mean, there's nothing, no act. There's no even non-activity that you cannot make a case for under the Commerce Clause. And, of course, the original intent there was to prohibit states from having tariffs against other states. So go figure. I mean, we'll never go back to the way it was intended, but, you know, it's an example showing how the lower courts can nullify the Supreme Court holds. And in fact, like the felon in possession prohibitions under the Gun Control Act, there's a federal basis at least for it, that the gun had to have traveled interstate commerce. If the gun never crossed state lines, it cannot be a federal prosecution. It's an easy case to make because the guns say where they're, what state they're made in. But if you have a Smith & Wesson and you're in Massachusetts and you're a felon, unless they can show somehow it previously crossed state lines and came back, there's no federal case. So that's an example where at least they got a federal hook on the law. But when you go to the machine gun ban, that's a mere possession ban of any made after 1986, and they did not put in interstate commerce nexus there. And that led to challenges, both civil and criminal, and we ended up with several 2-1 opinions, but the courts ultimately upheld that. Judge Alito then was on the Third Circuit. He dissented on the Commerce Clause in an opinion. But then when the court did the Reich case on marijuana out of the California case that came out, that probably it's over now for Commerce Clause challenges. Now I want to move on to some discussion of McDonald, because it gets a lot better in terms of the original sources the court uses to illustrate the reasons for the 14th Amendment. Under the antebellum slave codes, African Americans were prohibited from having arms either as slaves or even as free blacks. A lot of those laws started out as licensing laws and then they went to bans. But after the Civil War ended and we have Reconstruction, if you look at McDonald, when it first starts discussing that subject, it cites one of my favorite statutes to illustrate the point, the Mississippi law. It said no freedmen, and it listed other categories similar to that, could carry or keep any firearm or other weapon without a license. So it was not an absolute ban, but you only needed a license. So you got a problem with that? I mean, you know, it's sort of like the good cause criteria, right? And that some states would have, or New York, to have a license to carry, you have to show good cause, or Massachusetts. I mean, there's any number of states that have that. The Mississippi statute could have just as well put in good cause, but the McDonald decision uses that to illustrate the very kind of law that the 14th Amendment was designed to prohibit. A law where an official would determine whether a person could carry a gun. So the 14th Amendment was not just to overcome the Southern Black Code provisions that would prohibit mere possession of a gun, but when you look at this example and you look at, there were some other, I think the court referred to a Louisiana law, and if you look that up, it was another you can't carry without a license law. It was not an absolute ban. And in fact, if you look at most of those Southern laws at that time, they were licensing laws. And so then you get the argument that, well, the 14th Amendment was only to prohibit inequality. So if you treated everybody the same and deprived all of them of rights, then that would be okay. Now, the McDonald case deals with that argument, because Chicago said that if you ban handguns to everybody, there's no violation of the 14th Amendment. Well, that's the equal protection component of the 14th Amendment. That's not the other parts of the 14th Amendment, whether we find them in the Due Process Clause, the Privileges or Immunities Clause, or the Citizenship Clause. Those aren't about equality. Those are about rights and some kind of floor. And this is where your historical research, I think, can really pay off. And you'll see in the core brief that I did, there's a lot of references to laws of this type. And one of the most, I think, important aspects of what came out of the Congress before the 14th Amendment was the Civil Rights Act of 1866 and the Freedmen's Bureau Act of 1866, where they both started out as companion bills. The Civil Rights Act and the Freedmen's Bureau Act referred to a right to full and equal benefit of all laws and proceedings for the security of person and property. And then the Freedmen's Bureau Act language added, including the constitutional right to bear arms. And you can believe me, they weren't talking about bearing arms in the militia. They were talking about self-defense. And both of them got vetoed. The Civil Rights Act, there was an override vote that was successful. And so that didn't explicitly mention bearing arms. But then that law was reintroduced and improved, and it referred to the right to personal security, personal liberty, and personal property. And personal security, that's a catch-all phrase. If you look at Blackstone, the right of personal security include the right to have arms for preservation and defense. So that language, of course, that law later expired because the Freedmen's Bureau no longer existed after a certain time. But the court in the McDonald case does play up that language as illustrative of the fact that there was a right to bear arms, a constitutional right to bear arms, and it even says that that same would be guaranteed in the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which is still in the books, which makes an intriguing question. Could you litigate under, what is it, under 19? There's 1981 and 1982 of Title 42 USC that it's now split between. I forgot which one of them now has that language, but the language is still in the books. and Chicago had argued, by the way, that that was another provision for equality, but then the court came back and said, well, it says full and equal protection for these rights, not just equal protection for these rights. So equal deprivation of those rights would not do it. The Freedmen's Bureau Act language, I think I'm the first one that really wrote a lot about that in the book Freedmen, the 14th Amendment and the Right to Bear Arms, published in 1998. We had lost the first challenge to a ban on rifles in U.S. history, which was the Roberti Ruiz so-called assault weapon ban from California. And we had brought up that language about the Freedmen's Bureau Act, which had not been used previously in litigation. And the Ninth Circuit, they upheld the law, and they didn't really want to admit that there was something that clear in terms of the intent of the 14th Amendment. So they just referred, in their opinion, to debates on the Freedmen's Bureau bill or something like that, but they didn't mention that it passed by the same two-thirds of Congress that passed the 14th Amendment. It had, the second time the Freedmen's Bureau bill had come up for a vote, it was vetoed, but then there was an override vote, and which was successful. And if you look at every member who voted for the Freedmen's Bureau Act, they also voted for the 14th Amendment. The people who voted against the one voted against the other one. And there's no other right in the Bill of Rights that had that kind of sanction by the authors of the 14th Amendment. You won't find any similar act of Congress mentioning free speech or press or any of the other so-called preferred rights of today. So there's, as I say, there's some really good material in the McDonald case on this. And then there's some really good material also on the Civil Rights Act of 1871. Of course, that's what we all use now in pursuing these challenges to state deprivations of rights. 42 U.S.C. 1983. The legislative history of that also has many comments about the right to keep and bear arms. And if you look at Supreme Court decisions, the major landmark cases construing Section 1983, like Patsy is a good one of the best. They have a lot of reliance on the congressional debates from 1870 and 1871. And you can look at the speeches they're quoting, and on the same pages of those same speeches you have reference to the right to keep and bear arms is a right of all citizens. And so in Patsy and other cases like that, they didn't mention that, but they talked. Court talked about this fact. So finally, in the Reconstruction discussion in Heller and then more so in McDonald, you have a number of references to section 1983, and that being used or intended to support cases challenging firearm prohibitions. So I just took my watch off and I noticed I've gone way over.
Oh, it's okay. But you're good.
I better close here. I don't know. I don't have to, what, you know, like it's 3 o'clock. It's time for me to shut up.
But I have a question.
And Nick Johnson is going to give, I'm sure, a really cool address, and I don't want to intrude on his time.
But do you want to conclude, or do you want to take a question?
Well, I don't want to mess up the schedule. I mean, I'm glad to.
There's some fluidity.
Elasticity,
whatever. I have a question, and this is not exactly right to carry, but rather about the home. And it deals with, how about a temporary home? How about a hotel room as a home? How about a tent? How about a homeless person living in a cardboard box? I mean, we all exist somewhere. So what about those other aspects? I mean, does somebody who lives in a tent, does he have no right to keep even in his own tent?
Well, you know, the Second Amendment language doesn't restrict to the home. I mean, that's what lower courts are now saying about Heller, that the right's limited to the home, but that's an opinion of the court. That's not the Constitution. And in fact, I mean, I think keeping mostly pertains to the home, but I think it pertains outside the home as well. It means they can't just take it away from you. If there's a right, if there's any meaning to the right to bear arms, certainly in these temporary places of abode, you would have that right. And all places of abode are temporary. No house is permanent.
Life is temporary.
Right, life is temporary. So, yeah.
Just on that note, do you think that those courts are kind of treating analogous to the Fourth Amendment in the sense that in Fourth Amendment law, cars are generally treated as places where there's a lot less privilege than the house? So if you're asking questions about other temporary places of privacy, the court, just like with the Fourth Amendment, just unwilling to really buy the same notions outside of the home that that has.
Don't give them that idea, because that sounds persuasive. And none of them have come up with that. Now that's, I'm sure they would like to have that to buttress what they're saying. You know, they've got the incredibly shrinking Fourth Amendment.
Right.
And it shrinks the more you get out of your home. And now they just accepted cert in this case where they take the dog sniffing, the dog sniffer right up to the door.
Right.
And not only the dog smell marijuana, but the cop said he smelled marijuana, which I don't believe for a minute.
You get to go up
there. Yeah, on the right here. Yes.
You mentioned that Supreme Court denied cert in a couple of what seemed to me to be, you know, uncomfortable cases. Do you read anything bigger into that, or is that just timing? They've got a lot of big cases on their shelf this month, this year.
One thing I've tried to learn to do is never read anything they do. You don't know why they do things. You don't know why they take cases when they take them. They might think it's too early, or maybe let's use Scalia as an example. He doesn't think that he's got a majority, or, I mean, there's any number of reasons why individual justices would inclined to recommend that.
Without knowing, has there been a lot of, academic blowback for the justices on these that you can tell? A lot of scathing articles, a lot of scathing critiques of.
Of Heller and McDonald?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. A couple of years, or a year and a half ago, American Association of Law Schools, I was just telling Joyce to think about this. We had a conference, Jack Rakoff, one of the main collective rights view people, and then there was another professor, I can't remember his name. They were comparing the Heller decision to Dred Scott. And they made the most malicious comments about individual justices.
Citizens United? I thought that was Dred Scott.
It's really malicious and ad hominem, the kind of attacks. Yeah, in the very back.
The one thing about the cert denials that comfort from if one was so minded. Neither Williams, the Maryland case, nor Machindara, if I said that right, you could argue that neither of them was a clean case procedurally because Maryland technically did have this limited but existent regime for issuing permits, and Williams had not applied for one. And would imagine that the Supreme Court didn't want to get into standing or anything like that with that case. And then Machindaro wasn't a fundamental, is there a right to carry at all case, but was about whether the government could prohibit carrying in government parks.
Right.
So we'll really know something maybe when we get, you know, a clean case, especially if it's one from Illinois or D.C. where there's a complete carry ban. But anyway, I just wanted to say one thing that, Steve, you observe, which I totally agree with, that Heller had both the broad holding and the narrow holding, and all of these lower courts are acting as if the only holding in the case was a ban on handgun possession and use in the home violates the Second Amendment. But Heller also had a broad holding, and it was that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to keep and bear arms for the purpose of self-defense. And the reason I know that that was part of it is because the McDonald Court said so in the first sentence of the McDonald plurality opinion, and then Justice Thomas used the exact same words in the first page of his concurrence. And the reason I know it was a holding is because a majority of the Supreme Court said so.
Right, they used the word holding, didn't they?
They said both Alito's plurality and the Thomas concurrence of McDonald say, in the exact words, you can tell they were doing this carefully, we held in Heller that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to keep and bear arms for the purpose of self-defense.
Right.
And it doesn't say self-defense in the home. So what these lower courts have to say is a complete ban on carrying handguns outside the home consistent or inconsistent with a right to bear arms for the purpose, an individual right to bear arms for the purpose of self-defense.
Steve, in case you don't know, that is Professor Michael O'Shea. You may not have met face-to-face yet.
Yeah.
Michael, okay. Yeah. This is Michael O'Shea.
I sure know who Steve is.
Yeah, and one last comment, and I got to let
Nick
go on. In Williams, the AG of Maryland represented that 85% or something like that of the people who apply get permits. But what they didn't tell you is that everybody knows you're not going to get it, and they tell you you're not going to get it, so why are you going to pay them money to get it? So that's an example how they basically misrepresented the fact. But be that as it may, thank you.
Thank you very much.